So this miswa of Yishuv Haaretz, and I stressed before there's Yishuv and there's Yeshivat Haaretz, and I'll explain in one moment the difference. This miswa of Yishuv Haaretz, the Rambam definitely writes, without a doubt. And the Rambam writes something similar another place, in the Chot Avadim, which I didn't quote here. There's a halakha which states that if an Eved, that Eved Kana'ani of a Jew, a Jewish master, in Chutz La'aretz, runs away from his master, but he's also considered a Jew. And Eved Kana'ani is a Jew, he undergoes a form of conversion. He's Chayav B'Miswoth. Ki'isha, and he's also chayav therefore b'miswat yishivat haaretz. So it says mefurash in the different mefarshim. If an eved Kana'ani runs away from his Jewish master in Chutz La'aretz and runs away to Eretz Yisrael, it's asur to return this eved to his master in Chutz La'aretz. The Rambam brings this halacha in Ichot Avadim. Obviously, again, the Rambam knows there's such a miswa and recognizes the miswa. So what exactly, first of all, I want to clarify these three terms. I keep saying I'll make clear the difference, the distinction between these terms. We have therefore three categories. We have Yerushat Ha'aretz, which is the comprehensive miswa, which is the essential miswa of the Torah when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, which the Ramban described for us, which is the miswa of the Jewish people entering the land, taking control of it, setting up a state, and dwelling here, etc., etc. And then as derivatives or subheadings, as it were, of that major miswa, we have two other miswat which are also considered to be minat Torah, as we've described now. One is Yishuv Haaretz and one is Yeshivat Haaretz. Yishuv Haaretz is the purchasing of land or a house or what have you in Eretz Israel. In other words, taking it from the possession of a non-Jew and bringing it into the possession of a Jew. By the way, that has nothing at all to do with the actual dwelling on that property. In other words, Yehezkel Kohen in London, who bought this property, this piece of land or this house in Haifa from John Smith, doesn't have to live there. If he doesn't, it's a very good thing if he does, it's wonderful if he does, but if he never lives there and never has any intention of living there, he still is performing the miswa of Yishuv Haaretz by buying it from John Smith. The actual purchase, the removal of this property from this ownership to this ownership, to the ownership of a Jew, is Yishuv Haaretz in itself, because now this piece of land doesn't belong to a person who doesn't belong there. That's what Rashi says, Legaresh Goyim Uliyashev Yisrael Ba. The two sides to this miswa of Yishuv Haaretz are to remove the Jewish ownership, the non-Jewish ownership or the non-Jewish presence, Legaresh Goyim Uliyashev Yisrael Ba, and wherever possible also to settle Jews on that property, any place in Eretz Yisrael. So even the removal, it's not mentioned anywhere in any of the places that we mentioned, not in the Gemara, in the Sechagitin, not in the Shulchan Aruch, not in the Rambam, that the Jew who bought this piece of land from the Goy on Shabbat is required to live there. It's also not mentioned that it has to be his intention that if he won't live there, then his son will live there, or he'll give it to his best friend to live there. That's not part of the halacha at all. One assumes that maybe at some point, B'zat Hashem, some Jew will live there. That's the general purpose. But the very fact of the changing of hands of ownership from one to the other, that itself is already considered Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Whereas Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael is the dwelling, the actual residing in Eretz Yisrael itself. In other words, a person can even perform that miswa, even if he doesn't own the land. He can live in someone else's house. Someone gave him a house to live in Yerushalayim. It's not his house, but he's living in Eretz Yisrael. That's Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael right there. He's renting, or it's a gift, whatever. The person says, live there rent-free for the next year. I don't need it. That Jew who lives there rent-free in this house in Yerushalayim is performing the miswa of Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael. And that also is a tremendous miswa, and it's also Minat Torah. And how do we know it's Minat Torah? One way we know this is the source which is quoted in number two on your source sheet, which is a Gemara Masechet Ketubot, Daf Kof Yud Aleph. It's quoted here by Or HaHayim, which I want to read in a moment. The source says, the second line, Shekol HaOlech Ba'arba Amot Yesh Lo Chelek L'Am Haba. Says in the Gemara there that any person, even a Shifcha Kana'anit, who's also a Jew, as we say, even a Shifcha Kana'anit, who walks, who resides in Eretz Yisrael, even walks in an Ani Arba Amoth, Yesh Lo Chalek L'Am Haba. You won't find Chazal making such a statement about some Miswa Midrabanan, right? Or some minor Inyan, which is not an essential part of the Torah. It's obvious that such a statement is telling you this is such an essential and important and crucial element of the Torah, that anyone who connects himself in any way to Eretz Yisrael is Ish L'Chalek L'Am Habba.
Is there per se a higher Madrega in owning versus renting?
I think there is. It is a higher Madrega, so to speak, because then there's also Yeshiva and also Yeshuv.
I think Yeshuv means you purchase it from a non-Jew, or just you purchase it at all?
even look, if one Jew buys a house from another Jew, well, they are both Jews, so there's no advantage, so to speak, from the point of view of the Jewish people. From the point of view of Yerushat Haaretz, nothing's changed. But for the individual Jew who buys, something's changed for him. Now he owns a piece of land, a house, whatever, in Eretz Yisrael. That is a great thing. That is a tremendous thing in and of itself. He's performing a mitzvah by being someone who owns land in Eretz Yisrael. Yes, there is. This is also a concept which comes up in the Sherot and Teshuvot already in the time of the Rishonim. Rashi writes in the Tshuva, for example, that every Jew has at least Arba Amot Eretz Yisrael. In other words, every Jew is considered to have to own at least some part of Eretz Yisrael. Yes. Very good. Now I'm getting to this part of the discussion.
How is it that if I did can rationalize that this is no longer ethical? That, you know, we have it for 2,000 years, we'll have it again. It's like a paper plate.
All right. Now I'm turning to this question here. As we saw at length, the Ramban claims that the Rambam with a mem did not mention the miswa of Yerushat Haaretz in his Sefer Miswot. The Ramban, however, brought us many sources to show that it is a miswa. Clearly it's a miswa. He brought Psukim, he brought the Sifrei, he brought the Gemara, many, many sources. And we saw sources now which indicate clearly that even Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, even by a Jew living in Chutz Laaretz in the time of Galuth, if he can purchase a piece of land from a non-Jew on Shabbat, that's Yishuv Haaretz, which allows one to override Amir Al-Goy. So Lichora, the Ramban, is on very safe ground when he makes these claims, and we have to ask ourselves, what does the Ramban with the mem think about all this? All right, so there are many answers have been offered by different Chachamim, different Mefarshim. I will mention two at least in this shiur now. One is not quoted here on the source sheet in front of you, but I'll give it over to you ba'al peh. There's a book called Megillat Esther, written by a certain Rishon from Sfarad, which is basically a kind of a perush on certain parts of the Sefer Miswot of the Rambam. And the main purpose of this perush, Megillat Esther, is to defend the Rambam with a mem from the Ramban's attacks and hasagoth. And when it comes to this Miswat Aseh Dadad, the Ramban with the Nun wishes to add to the list of Miswat Aseh, the Mechilat Esther writes as follows. He says that the Miswa of Yerushat Haaretz, that is to say, we're talking here about the overall Miswa of conquering and sovereignty and Jewish nationhood, etc. This Miswa only applied at the time of Yehoshua and in the time of David HaMelech and up until the time of the destruction of the first Mikdash. But from the time that Am Yisrael went into Galuth, at the time of the destruction of the first Mikdash, when they went to, most of the people were taken to Bavel, etc. From that time and until the time of Yimot HaMashiach, this Miswa is on hold. Now I see that your head tilts to the side and you're asking yourself, no doubt, so I imagine, how does this work? Where does such an idea come from? Very good question. I actually do not know exactly where it comes from, although I can attempt to understand it and give it some meaning, even though I admit freely that I do not accept such an explanation. I don't think such a thing is possible. I'm not aware of any halachic mechanism by which a miswa can exist and then all of a sudden go on hold, you put on a back burner, you put on ice for a period of time, whether it's a century or seven centuries or whatever, and then somehow be thawed out and it returned to life, reactivated.
Isn't that the way we handle the Beit HaMikdash in general?
Not at all. Absolutely not. I wouldn't say that at all. There's a miswa at all times to build a Beit HaMikdash. The question is whether you're able to do it.
It's a bit cryotic.
Hmm?
A bit cryotic.
What do you mean?
Cryonics about thawing out. So
ah, I see. The general rule, the way I would explain, the way I would present all such issues, is that all the miswat of the Torah exist for all time, equally, in all generations. As the Ramban wrote here, the Ramban, who was obviously fully aware of the reality of the Jewish people in Galuth, etc., the Ramban wrote here, if you remember, in the last paragraph, "In ken hin miswat asel dorot mithayev kol yachid mimenu afilo bezban galuth." So said the Ramban. So what's going on here? All miswat exist at all time. There's a miswa for the Jewish people to inherit and to control Eretz Yisrael always. There's a miswa for the Jewish people at all times to build the Beth Mikdash. There's a miswa for the Jewish people at all times to establish the Sanhedrin. The question is whether we're capable or whether we're anus. We're not in the situation where we can do it. Just as an individual Jew has a miswa to have a lulav and an etrog on Sukkot, and if he happens to live in Siberia, or in Estonia or Lithuania, and the shipment of etrogim from Spain or from Greece didn't arrive that year, and believe me, it happened plenty, it happened all the time, then that year the Jew didn't have an etrog. Does that mean there's no miswa etrog this year? Of course there's a miswa. He's anus, he has no etrog. Hashem will forgive me, he couldn't do anything about it, he did the best he could. And so much so was it a reality that happened frequently that in Yiddish there's an expression that when something's useless and no longer of any value, one says in Yiddish that it's welt via esrogim nachsikus. It's worthwhile as a trogim that arrive after Sukkot. In other words, often it happened that the package that was sent to you by someone else, another Jew in the world, didn't arrive on time. Happened plenty. Happened often, unfortunately. But we wouldn't say that the miswa doesn't exist. In the same way, the Rambam with the men would definitely tell you, this is, I think, one of the essential points of the Rambam's entire Shita, that all the miswot of the Torah always apply at all times, in all generations. The only issue is, if it's a miswot which requires the Jewish people to be in a certain state of national existence, a certain state of readiness and organization, etc., the question is whether the Jewish people are capable of, as you would say today, getting their act together, whether they can do it. For a long time, obviously, the Jewish people were not able to get their act together sufficiently to establish a state in Eretz Yisrael. All of a sudden, at some point in history, two generations ago, it happened. It became a reality. And that also only happened because the Jews, certain Jews, a certain critical mass of Jews decided they were going to make it happen. But it did happen. Even though for a very, very long time, roughly, shall we say, 2,000 plus years, it did not happen. But that miswa was always there. It was always there, not even in the background. It's always there right in the foreground. But not always can you do everything the Torah wants you to do. There's a miswa, for example, of Korban Pesach. Today also there's a miswa of Korban Pesach. And yet we didn't have one this past Nisan. And unfortunately, I think it's probably true to say we won't have one this coming Nisan either. That doesn't mean there's no miswa. It means that we're anus, or we're being prevented from doing so by other people. It doesn't matter who those people are right now. Maybe it does matter, but that's not the issue today. We're being prevented from doing that which we would like to do, that which the Torah commands us to do, but that doesn't mean the miswa is not there. So what the Megillat Esther is suggesting is an entirely different approach to the Yahaduth, which is that some parts of the Torah apply at some point, at some time, and then because of the reality of Galuth, they cease to exist, and they basically go into some kind of state of chronics, as we said, as we mentioned here, sort of some deep freeze, and they can be thawed out at some later point when the Mashiach comes, which is another way of saying that all these miswot are basically off the law books. They've been removed from the law books for now, for the foreseeable future, until the Mashiach arrives. And when the Mashiach arrives, he'll worry about it. But really, the Jewish people, from the point of view of the Megillat Esther, from that position that he's presenting, the Jewish people are really patur from worrying about this miswa. So whereas the Rambam, in my opinion, nothing would be further from could be further from the Rambam's way of looking at things. Yes.
That's similar to conservative reform of saying, you know, halacha does apply. We don't have to keep kosher, we keep Shabbos, we don't have to keep mitzvah. We have to do those things because that's too hard in this day and age, and it's backwards anyway.
I don't think it's fair to. To compare the Megillat Esther to the conservative or the reform movement. I don't think that's what he has in mind. I don't think it's contrived at all. If you can put yourself, so to speak, into his shoes. The Megillat Esther also quotes another source. There is such an opinion, it's a fact, in the Talmud Bavli, certainly there is such an opinion, which states that it's asur for a Jew to go on Aliyah from Bavel to Eretz Israel. Which seems strange, to say the least. There was such an opinion. It was held by Rav Yehuda, for example, in the Gemara, so much so that when some of his Talmudim, like Rabbi Zera, or Rabbi Zeura, wanted to go on Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael from Bavel. He didn't accept this opinion of Rav Yehuda. He avoided seeing Rav Yehuda for the period leading up to his Aliyah. He didn't want to get into an argument with him about it, because Rav Yehuda didn't think he was doing the right thing. But Rabbi Zera, obviously, he was doing the right thing. And many Amoraim at that time in history, in that period, in the first, second, third generations of the Amoraim, we see there are many Amoraim who came from Bavel originally and went on Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. So obviously this opinion wasn't accepted by all. In fact, probably it was not accepted by the vast majority. But there is an opinion which is mentioned in the Talmud Bavli, based on a certain pasuk, a certain understanding of a certain pasuk, that the Jews, having been brought to Bavel, are to remain there until the Mashiach comes, or something like that.
Use the first time.
It's not funny. This is exactly the Sutner philosophy, but transposed 1500 or 1700 years back in time. No, you're absolutely right. This is the same kind of thinking. I think it's entirely true to say that there is a certain thread if not a school of thought, or at least there is a certain thread of such thought in our sources from the ancient times already, which the Rebbe Misaton picked up on and developed into an entire shita. In other words, I'll be the first to admit there are certain sources which indicate some of the things that he suggested. I would also say that that's not the halacha, that's not the mainstream opinion. That's rejected by the majority of the chachamim throughout history. But there is such an opinion which could lead a person to reach certain conclusions of that type. Yes.
There is a significant Sutner community in Eretz Yisrael. We should take note of
that. That's also true. That's also true. And they would tell you there's no problem, there's no stira, there's no contradiction in between these two positions, thinking along these lines and living in Eretz Yisrael. The contradiction that in their eyes would be perhaps establishing Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael before the Mashiach comes, or something like that. This, of course, has a lot to do with understanding the concept of Mashiach in general. What is the Mashiach? How does it work? What does it mean to wait for the Mashiach? How do you wait? Don't you wait? What do you do? Which we're not going to discuss this evening, because we've discussed it in the past. Maybe we'll discuss it also in the future again. But it goes without saying that the Rambam and the Megillat Esther are talking almost in totally different terms, different languages. They're not communicating at all, even though they weren't living in the same time. But the Megillat Esther is saying things the Rambam would simply not understand. What are you talking about? What do you mean this from Miswan, the time of Yeshua and David the Melech, until the time of the Churban Arishon? And from that time onwards, there's no Miswa, and it will only become Miswa when the Mashiach returns. Where did you find this? He would ask the Megillat Esther. Where did you find such an idea? Where is this written in the words of Chazal? And if you're basing it on the opinion of Rav Yehuda or something like that, first of all, it doesn't refer to Yerushat HaAretz, it doesn't refer to any of these things really. And second of all, we see that that's not the accepted opinion. We see that most of the Amoraim did not accept this opinion. And therefore, to base yourself on such a thing is very, 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 very flimsy argument. But so says the Megillat Esther. So what the Megillat Esther, and even though it's really paradoxical, because the Megillat Esther is trying to explain the position of the Ramban against the Ramban's questions and kushyot. But really what he's presenting, what he's offering for the Ramban, so to speak, is something which is clear to me. The Ramban would never agree to, never accept, never want to have said for him in 1,000 years. It has nothing to do with the Ramban's position. So if we do not accept this position of the Megillat Esther, which as I think was mentioned correctly, is something like a Satmar position, which is, I think, light years away from the Rambam's world and position in Hashkafa. So what, in fact, is the Rambam's understanding? Why would the Rambam not mention Sasha Miswa in his Sefer Miswa? The Orach Chaim, which is the second source on the source sheet in front of you, in his Perush to Dvarim Perek Lamed Pasuk Kaf, the Torah here speaks about the bracha and the klala that were just mentioned earlier. This is in the end of Parshat Nisavim, and it says in Perek Lamed Pasuk Teth Wal, for example, Ra'e Natati Lefanecha Hayom Et HaChaim Ve'et HaTov Et HaMaweth Ve'et HaMaweth Ve'et HaRa, etc., etc. Im yifne levavecha v'rot ishma v'nidachta v'ishtahawit al Elohim achirim v'avadtam, if you will worship other gods, etc., etc. Higati lachem hayom, I am telling you now, says Hashem, ki avot tovedun, you will be destroyed. Lo tarichun yamim al ha'adama asher ata overet hayaden levo shama l'rishta, you will not remain on your land that you are going to inherit. I have place before your life and death, habracha wa kilala, uvaharta b'chayim, and you shall choose life, lema'an tichye ata uzarecha, so that you and your descendants shall live, in other words, in Eretz Israel, and that you shall be zocheh to do what? La'ahava et Adonai Elohecha, to love Hashem, lishmua b'kolo u'davka bo, to listen to his, follow Hashem's instruction and cleave to Hashem. Ki hu hayecha v'orech yamecha. Lashevet al ha'adama asher nishba Adonai l'avotecha l'Avraham l'Yitzhak l'Yaakov l'tet lahem. These are the psukim in Sefer Dvarim about which the Orachim speaks. And on the last pasuk where it said that you will be zocheh if you listen to Hashem's Torah and act upon it, you will be zocheh to be in Eretz Yisrael. Lashevet al ha'adama. The Orachim says, Kilu amar wala shevet. In other words, this itself is a great schuth. To be in Eretz Yisrael is a great schuth itself. Wadavar ze gamhu mi'asagat ha-shlemuth. This is also something which brings a person to a level of shlemuth. Ki yeshivat ha'ares hi miswa koleleth kol ha-Torah, says Orachim. The dwelling in Eretz Yisrael is something which encompasses the entire Torah. Se ulemad mimam ramzal, as they say, as the Chachamim said in Masechet Ketubot, shekol ha'olech ba'arba'amot yesh lo chelek l'am haba shekulo chayim. What is the Or HaChaim is saying something here which is very, very powerful and which can be used, I think, to explain, to offer an explanation why the Rambam does not list this as a separate miswa. Because what we have to understand really is that it's not because it's not important according to the Rambam, this miswa of Yerushat HaAretz that the Ramban spoke of. It's not because it's not important or not major enough, shall we say, that the Ramban leaves it out. It's quite the opposite. It's because it is so major and so fundamental and so central to the entire Torah that it's not a specific miswa in and of itself. It's like it's the underpinning of the entire Torah. As the Or HaChaim says, he miswa kolelet kol haTorah. It's the basis of the entire Torah. Everything the Rambam tells you, wherever you look in the Rambam, when the Rambam tells you nechot bet ha-bechira, there's a miswa that says to build a Beit Mikdash. Very nice. Where do you build a Beit Mikdash? In London? In Paris? In Warsaw? Where can you build a Beit Mikdash? Obviously, only in Eretz Yisrael, nechon? There's a miswa that says. The Rambam says a miswa that says, and lechol haDorot, it's a miswa. When the Rambam tells you there's a miswa to have a malchut, to establish a Jewish monarchy and sovereignty, where is he talking about? What's he saying? Where are the Jews supposed to do this? In Canada, as we suggested before, or New Zealand? Where are they supposed to go and do this, establish this Jewish monarchy? Obviously, now it's Israel. When the Rambam tells you that it's a miswa to have a Sanhedrin, which has its chambers in Ishkat HaGazith next to the Beit Mikdash, where is this supposed to happen? Obviously, all these things can only take place in a certain, very specific place on the globe, on the map. That's Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is an assumption. It's not a miswa in itself. It's an assumption. It's a given. It's not a specific act which you must perform. It's the basis for all the other acts that you're supposed to perform.
It's seen as a belief in God in general. I mean, the first one that's called Sefer Mitzvot is belief in Hashem, and the Ramban fights it with Ramban.
True. You have a good point. But I would tell you that all the Monei Misvoth, all the Chachamim who tried to write a book of Terek Misvoth, ran up against the same problem. That no matter what system of rules and principles you try and develop in order to assist you in deciding which Misvoth you include and which you do not include, it never quite works out. The Rambam seems to have left out or to have added extra things. The Ramban also has a problem. He adds things, he takes away things, doesn't quite come out to the right number. The Ramban also, by the way, says he's not even sure it has to be exactly 613. That's also true. All the Chachamim ran into the same problem, all of them. And the Gra, the Gaon Mivilna, by the way, said something in this regard, which I think is important to mention. And he said, really, that all the Monei Misvoth, he says that you can ask Kushiyot about all the Minyanim, the way the Rambam lists it, and the way the Smag lists it, and the way the Halachot Gevalot lists the Tayyar Misvoth. You can have good questions on all of them. And the Gra said, the answer is, the solution to this conundrum is that the Torah consists of 613 principles. In other words, general principles, which we call miswoth. And from those 613 general principles, all kinds of things are derived. All kinds of things spin off, as we describe with Yerushat HaAretz and the spin-off of Yeshivat HaAretz and Yishuv HaAretz. All the miswoth are like that. And the kunz, the difficulty is to know what to name, what to list as the headline of the mitzvah, the heading, and what is the subheading. Sometimes the difficulty is that one of the Munei Mitzvot, maybe the Rambam, quotes both the heading and one of the subheadings. And another Chacham will say, wait a second, that subheading doesn't belong, you should only quote the heading. Another one will say, no, Bichlal, that's also not a heading, that really belongs to, that's part of another Mitzvah over here, you understand? So it's all a question of how you define what the general principles are and what the spin-off Mitzvot are. What are the derivatives? In other words, there's level A and level B and level C, shall we say. And that's a very difficult thing to...
Go back to Rabbi Simlai's footnote. When he said the quote, what did he mean?
The trouble is that Rabbi Simlai did not give us a list. Nowhere do Chazal give us a list of 630 Mitzvot. If that were the case, you really wouldn't have a problem. I think, by the way, I'll just mention in passing, I think of all the posukim, all the Chachamim who tried to come up with a list of Tayag Mitzvot, the one who succeeded perhaps more than anyone, I think, is the Rashbats. Rashbats would be, I think, Shimshon Bar Semach, if I'm not mistaken, his name. Originally he was from Provence, from the south of France, but he moved to Algiers, and he was in North Africa most of his life, towards the end of the time of the Rishonim. He wrote many important Sfarim. One of them is called Zohar HaRakia, which is a perush on it goes as follows. There's the minyan of the Mitzvot according to the Halachot Gedolot, which is one of the first that we have, going back about 1300 years. Rabbi Shlomo ibn Gevirol from Spain, who was a poet, took that minyan of the Mitzvot and turned it into a beautiful piyut. In other words, he turned it into a beautiful poetic list of Mitzvot, which includes all the Mitzvot according to the Halachot Gedolot. He took this piyut and he wrote a perush on the piyut. It was a whole book in itself called Zohar HaRakia, where he discusses everything, the Rambam and the Ramban, etc., and each Mitzvah. And towards the end of the Sefer, he initially, it's very interesting, Rashbas writes originally that I tried, and there's no way I can come up with the exact number that fits all the rules and all the principles and all the guidelines that I myself have given you, etc. So it's very, I can't do it. I haven't got to the right solution yet. Apparently he wrote this earlier in his life, because later he wrote an afterword, so to speak, to the book, another chapter, and he says, I looked at it again and I think I have the solution. And he presents another couple of rules and suggestions, and according to that he comes up with a suggestion, a list of Tayag Mitzvot, which seems to be very firm ground, which is difficult to take issue with. At any rate, the whole question of the Tayag Mitzvot is a very problematic issue, and on almost every shita, as I mentioned the name of the gra, you can ask a kushya. So you can ask the kushya, and it's a valid kushya, I'm not denying that. You could say this is a miswak, it says that, and that's the problem. The whole question of Yakim Mitzvot and how to classify them is a problem. That's a kushya, but the fact is it makes a lot of sense. To me at least it makes a lot of sense to say what the Orachaim here says. And I've also heard certain other rabbanim, I'll quote a couple to you now, or at least one that I recall who mentioned something along these lines. Rav Dov Lior, you may have heard of, Rav Kiat Arba, I saw once in a certain book that he wrote as follows, that just as it says in the Torah, just as it does not say in the Torah, it doesn't command us, there's no Miswa telling us that we have to breathe. Everyone knows that it's not even something that you have to think about, by the way. It's an autonomous process which the body does naturally, and you can't even stop yourself breathing if you try, because that's a given. If a person is to live, he has to breathe, and therefore something which is so fundamental to a person's existence, obviously the Torah doesn't tell you have to breathe. Also, by the way, it doesn't tell you have to eat. It just says if you do eat, you have to say Birkat HaMazon. It doesn't say you have to eat, because it's obvious you have to eat to live. Nahon? In the same way, he said Am Yisrael, being in Eretz Yisrael and living here as an independent nation, is like breathing for an individual human being. That's the basis of Jewish existence on the national level, not the Galuth mode of Jewish existence, but the normative mode of Jewish existence. That's the essential and the most fundamental basic requirement for the Jewish people to be here. Without that, half the Torah doesn't exist, as we said before. Mith Mikdash and Sanhedrin and Malchuth and Trumoth and Masroth and Shemitah, and the list goes on and on and on. None of these things make any sense. None of these things have any place. They're just, at best, some vague historic memory, which we mention here and there in some tefillah, or what have you, once or twice or three times a year, and that's it. You can't even begin to take the Torah seriously. You can't even begin to relate to most of the Torah unless you're talking about a situation where the Jewish people are in Eretz Yisrael. And then you have a foundation on which you can build, even if that foundation is shaky, as I would say, for instance, our present foundation here in Eretz Yisrael today is shaky. But it's better than being in a situation where you have no foundation at all. It's better to be in a situation where you have 5+ million Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, even though there's much that requires improvement. There's much that can still be improved upon, and much that we can complain about justly, etc., etc. Nevertheless, that reality of 5 million Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, which either ready today or in very short order will become the majority of the Jewish people, living in an independent state with an economy, with an army, with some national infrastructure, again, with all its faults and all the problems that we know of, that is a vastly preferable situation to a reality where the Jews are scattered all over the globe and they just have Jewish communities in different parts of the world and there's actually no Jewish national organism at all. That's where we are therefore in a vastly preferable and more advantageous situation, and there's much for us to do still, very much for us to do. And yet there's a foundation, there's a basis on which we can build. So I understand, based on amongst other things, Zohar HaHaim, who speaks of the yeshiva of Eretz Yisrael being a mitzvah kolelet, as we saw from different sources, that there's such a central concept and a fundamental mitzvah of the Torah. I can readily understand that from the Rambam's point of view, this is like an unstated, unwritten given on which the Torah is based. And we all know from the Torah itself, from the Tanakh, that the Jewish people entered Eretz Yisrael, the Jewish people fought for Eretz Yisrael. It's all written in the Torah, in Sefer Yoshua, in Sefer Shmuel, in Sefer Melachim. It's not as if we don't know these things. It's all very clear. And it's also a given that the Jewish people have to, at all times, strive to return to that normative situation. And I'll bring you from the Rambam himself, I think, very clear proof that the Rambam considers this to be a given, that the Jewish people must always strive to return to that normative situation. But if there was in fact no miswa at all, if there was no such concept in the Torah, why would we have to strive to do this? And that's exactly what the Megillat Esther, by the way, is saying. The Megillat Esther is saying the exact opposite of the Rambam. He's saying, until the Mashiach comes, we're not required to strive to do any of these things. We're not required to try and establish a state. We're not required to return and build a Mikdash. All these things are on hold until some future time, until something happens, until there's a great announcement or a great voice is heard from heaven stating that now the Mishwa is again operative or something.
It's so strange.
It is strange, but I think that's how it is.
But in so many obvious ways, just off really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I heard from Rabbi Gold and Harnow,
mm-hmm.
who talked about the famous idea that when there's a rove of Jews in Eretz Yisrael, the Shemitah will become the Arise.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, how could the Megillas Esther, that's the name of the... Yeah. So how could he explain that, I mean, is it not obviously preferable that we're doing a mitzvah de Arise of Shemitah in one or two more Shemitahs mm-hmm. when there's a rove of Jews in Eretz Yisrael, mm-hmm. than to not be here at all vis-a-vis the mitzvah?
I think it's clear that it's preferable, but he would tell you as follows. There is a gzerah, there's a reality, an historical reality the Jewish people find themselves in. A reality...
Found themselves in, not find.
Find and found, also.
No, because in 1940...
Well, all right, well, the Megillat Esther lived in the Middle Ages and lived today, so I don't know what he would tell you today, but from his point of view anyhow, certainly he would tell you, and by the way, the vast majority of the Haredi world doesn't accept your premise that in Tavshin Chet, in 1948, something essential, something crucial happened which changed the entire system, which forces us now to reappraise everything. They don't agree to this. So I'm trying to show you that it's not at all certain that the Megillat Esther wouldn't continue to say this, but the Megillat Esther certainly in his day was saying as follows. The Jewish people were sent into Galut, into a situation where they're are not a national organism any longer. They haven't got any of the wherewithal which allows them to do any of these things that the Torah discusses. And therefore, we have to understand, so the Megillat Esther would tell you, that Hashem has put us has placed us into another reality, and we're living now in a different mode, And that mode continues until such time as we're informed somehow, or it becomes apparent that again we're returning, we're shifting out of this mode and back into the original mode that we had earlier. And until such time, all these aspects of the Torah are simply on hold. That's his opinion.
Why would this 1948 events be possibly this shift that you just...
All right, well, I can't speak for the Megillat Esther, but I can tell you what certain Haredim would tell you, and that is that there's no Mashiach, and look at the people running the country, and look what's going on. So this is not the Geulah that we're talking about. This is not the Mashiach, and therefore we're still in the situation that we had before. We just happen now to be in so Bnei Brak as opposed to Warsaw,
or
opposed to Iraq.
Are they waiting for Nisim Gulim? You know, there should be earthquakes and rivers of blood and hails and locusts should be coming down.
For the locusts too.
It's getting pretty scary.
The locusts too.
The earthquakes are there too, and it's getting on the same.
I felt it.
Yes, many of us felt the earthquake, and some of us have seen the locusts. I actually have three in my freezer, if you want to know.
Just waiting for the chocolate.
Just waiting for the chocolate. Crafty, did you say?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's crafty. I would say it's very honest. I wouldn't say it's dishonest. I think that an entirely sincere and honest person from that hashkafa, from that world, and I mentioned before a very great chacham like Rav Shach, and again I reiterate that I had tremendous respect for him.
But you can disagree with
it. I disagree, but and I have a good basis to disagree. I have many delays to base myself on when I say this, but he was being entirely honest and forthright, not being crafty or devious in the least. He was telling you the truth. From my point of view, the way I understand Yahadut at the present time, at this point in history, and as it's been for many, many generations, as he said, for 2,000 years it was like this, it'll go on for as long as Hashem wants it to. All these things are not part of our purview.
So he was insisting that Yiddishkeit could be fulfilled, and it couldn't, because when we were in Russia, we couldn't do this system, couldn't do that system. Spain couldn't do this system, couldn't do that system. And Iraq couldn't do this, couldn't do that. And Iran couldn't do this, couldn't do that.
All right. Well, what would he say to you?
Pogroms and so on.
So what would he say? It's true. We always had to. We were always on the run. We were on the move.
Right.
And we're on the move today. Also, perhaps today we're here. Maybe tomorrow we'll be there, over there. Nothing essential. Nothing substantial changed here.
Right.
True. That's how Rav Shach, for example, understood the Jewish people's reality in the present generation. And that's how the entire Haredi world looks at the Jewish people's reality today. The focus is on wait for the Mashiach. When the Mashiach comes, Baruch Hashem, everything will work out. But I'm going to be hearing more than once the official representatives of the Haredi world, in other words, the Chavrei Knesset, different Rabbanim, Agudat Yisrael, and Degel HaTorah. I remember a couple of them expressing themselves in no uncertain terms and saying, if necessary, we'll leave the country, we'll go and we'll emigrate. I remember hearing that clearly. Do you therefore discern any commitment, any willingness to fight for, to defend Eretz Yisrael? This whole reality of a state is not of their doing. It's not something that they really understand, and they're not something they even wanted, really. They would not have bothered, from the Haredi point of view, it would not have bothered them one bit to live under as a British protectorate in the Middle East, for example.
Well, again, that would still be saying you could live here, and you can still live in your house on this piece of land under a different form of government, right? But what happens if they say you can't live here at all, you must leave?
If you're asking what I think would happen, I think they would pick up on me, number one. Number two, they would tell you, you're lucky if you can live here at all. If the British let you live here, so you have Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, you have a bit of Yeshuv Eretz Yisrael, and make do with that for now. When the Mashiach comes, we'll get the real McCoy, the Yerushat Eretz we'll have as well. Now it's not on the menu. That's the approach. That's how I see it. And I discern that same approach in the Megillat Esther. In other words, the Megillat Esther, I don't think he invented this approach. He didn't invent this Hashkafa. The Megillat Esther is giving voice to an approach, to an understanding, which was, I think, embedded in the minds of Jews in Chutz La'aretz, in Galuth, for generations going back hundreds of years and more, a general approach to Jewish existence, which basically says we're in Galuth and we're here for the long haul until Hashem removes us somehow, until the Mashiach comes, which is a very vague statement without really making it clear how it's supposed to happen, when it's supposed to happen, who's responsible for it happening. It's just there's a general passivity and acceptance, acquiescence in the reality of Galut. And this, by the way, as I've mentioned before, and I find it necessary to mention again, this is exactly where the Rambam with a Mem, and by the way, I think the Ramban also, but the Rambam certainly with a Mem is entirely different. He's coming from an entirely different place. The Rambam is the last Chacham, the last Posek who can be accused of acquiescing to the Galut. In other words, the Rambam views Yahadut and writes Yahadut and Mishneh Torah, as I'm about to show you in a moment, entirely from the position as if the Galut is some passing temporary phase in Jewish history which has to be overcome, and which B'zrat Hashem will be overcome soon. And he's always speaking about Yahadut in its original normative form, the Lechatchila version of the Torah. The Avad Galut version is something which the Rambam only pays lip service to where absolutely necessary. And that's exactly the opposite from what most of the Chachamim in his own day and before him and after him are doing. They're viewing the reality of Jewish existence and Yahadut, Yiddishkeit, whatever you want to call it, in the Galut reality as the norm, as it were, as the standard form of Judaism that we know. And anything beyond that as being something totally beyond the borders, beyond the pale of what we understand to be Yahadut. It's there, but it's not really part of what we know. We can't relate to it. That's how I see the Rambam, and I think I see this as being maybe the essential greatness of the Rambam.
Can we possibly explain that, though, as simply them being Miyayish in the sense of not being able to fathom a concept of conquering Eretz Yisrael? They were so weakened through that Golus, and there was no mechanism. I mean, let's face it, we couldn't have imagined, we as a Jewish people, even 3 years before 1948. Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, we see that as the low point. We were the ultimate, you know, downtrodden people. Mm-hmm. 3 years later, suddenly we were, you know.
You're absolutely right. I remember seeing a letter written by Rav Henkin, the original Rav Henkin, in Tashin Bet, 1942. And he was speaking about the Etzel and the Lehi, etc., who were busy fighting the British, who were starting to fight the British, whatever. And he said, these people are crazy, don't they understand that this talk about kicking the British out and establishing a Jewish state here is ridiculous, it will never happen. 6 years later it happened. It just shows you how, put it simply, how wrong a great Chacham, and he was a tremendous Chacham, can be in terms of reading the reality and appreciating the juncture in history in which we find ourselves. And in that sense, the Etzel and the Lehi and David Ben-Gurion had a much better appreciation of what was possible and how things could be done than Rav Henkin did, because I think Rav Henkin, with all his greatness, like most of the Rabbanim, like most of the Haredi world, all this talk about Jewish nationhood and fighting and establishing sovereignty, etc., this was totally foreign to them. They didn't understand even what was being discussed here. It didn't make sense. I really want to read a few lines from the Rambam from Ilchot Melachim Milchamot Perek Yudalef.
Credit, because I want to say Lahavdil Ben Gurion and Rav Henkin. To their credit, I think that the Rosh Yeshivas, like Rav Henkin, obviously were really focusing their efforts on the yeshivas and being dovek in, you know, in Limud Torah and so on. Whereas Ben Gurion really, you know, and such people. I mean, again, to their credit, Ben Gurion, but that really was his chiyas. He had nothing else.
You're right, but that's I think that's exactly the problem. In other words, when your focus on Yahadut, on Jewish existence, is limited only to the Beit Midrash and cannot encompass anything beyond the reality of the Beit Midrash, that is a very, very limited and therefore a system of Yahadut which is not authentic. It's lacking true authenticity and true scope. And that's exactly why the people whose focus is entirely on the Beit Midrash were not the ones who could do such a thing. It's only those people whose scope was much broader who could even imagine such things. And I think that's exactly the message, that Torah, the real Yahadut, as I was about to show you, that the Rambam describes it, encompasses all these things. And that's why I want to read to you what the Rambam says. This is by way of conclusion. The Rambam says in Ilchot Melachim Milchamot Perek Yud Aleph, when he's discussing the concept of a Melech HaMashiach and how it comes about, etc., he says as follows: Im ya'amod melech bibeth David, if a king from the house of David HaMelech arises and rules over the Jewish people, one assumes that's what a Melech is, a person who rules over a nation, And this person is a good Torah Jew. In other words, Hogeba Torah Vosek B'Mitzvot K'David Aviv. It doesn't have to be the Rav Rashi, it doesn't have to be the Gadol Ador, it doesn't have to be Rosh Yeshiva, but he has to be a Torah Jew who does the Mitzvot, who learns Torah, etc. Kefi Torah Shebichtav Sheba'al Peh. Uyachov Kol Yisrael Alech Ba Ulahazek Bidka. And this king, this leader of the Jewish people, will enforce the Torah and cause the Jewish people to live according to the Torah. Uyilahem Yilhamot Hashem, and will fight literally the battles of Hashem, and that is to say, fight the Jewish people's enemies and act in a manner which is always in accordance with the welfare of the Jewish people. Harei Zeh Behezkat Shu Mashiach. He is. We can begin to assume that he is the Mashiach. Im Asa Uhisliach, and if he succeeds in everything that he does, when Nisach Kol HaUmot SheSviva, and he succeeds in his wars against all the Jewish people's enemies, Uvana Mikdash B'Mekomo Kebes Midhay Yisrael, and builds the Mikdash, and in gathers the Jews from around the world, Harei Zeh Mashiach BeWadai. Then we can be certain that this is the Mashiach. Now that's a very beautiful statement of the Rambam, but we have to ask ourselves a simple question. It says Im Ya'amod Melech Mibet David. Rambam wrote this in the 12th century. Probably the lowest point in Jewish history, certainly in terms of the numbers of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. There were almost no Jews, literally handfuls of Jews in Eretz Yisrael in that period, in the 1100s. The Rambam passed through Eretz Yisrael briefly on his way to Mitzrayim. There was obviously nothing here at all. He couldn't survive here. There was nothing to do here. When the Ramban came to Eretz Yisrael about 100 years later or something, he also found in Rishonim, he talks about finding a handful of Jews. Things were very, very poor indeed. The Rambam says, if a melech, if a king arises and does A, B, and C, we can assume he's the Mashiach. Wait a moment. Where did this king come from? Where did he arrive from? How did he become king? Who made him king? How do you establish a monarchy? How do you appoint someone king? Obviously, there's something written here in the Rambam which is not written. It's on the white space between the lines. You have to understand that this is the assumption. There's a very clear assumption here. What the Rambam is saying, as follows: it is the Jewish people's responsibility at all times. This connects to what we were discussing before about the Miswa of Yishuv Haaretz, Yerushat Haaretz being a Miswa for all time. The Rambam says it's the Jewish people's responsibility at all times in history to do whatever they can to come to Eretz Yisrael in large numbers. Every Jew who can make it should come. As we saw, the Miswa of Yeshivat Haaretz, the Miswa of Yishuv Haaretz, it's a Miswa for every Jew to buy land here if he can. It's a Miswa for every Jew to come here if he can. It's a Miswa for the Jews as a whole and as a nation to come here in ever-increasing numbers until they reach some critical mass of Jewry, of the Jewish people here in Eretz Yisrael, because obviously 500 Jews or 1,000 Jews is not a nation and is not about to establish a monarchy and what have you. You need to have a very large number of Jews. We see historically, at least in Tafshin Ahith, it was 600,000 Jews. Interesting number, as we know. But the fact is that was roughly the number of Jews in Eretz Yisrael at that time. Tafshin Ahith, 1948.
Oh.
Okay, when the state was established, there were roughly 600,000 Jews in the country, as is well known. The same number of Jews described by the Torah at the giving of the Torah, of course, right? And at any rate, you need to have a critical mass of Jews, a large number, and the hope and the ambition is that large number of Jews will eventually somehow be able to organize themselves in such a manner so that they will be able to establish themselves as an independent nation. Again, historically we know that the countries, areas of the world are not left hefker. In other words, obviously when the first Jews arrive, the country is ruled by someone else, by crusaders, by Mamluks, by Arabs, by this, by that, by somebody. The idea is that if there's a sufficient number of Jews here, at some point they'll be able to rebel to somehow force the issue and gain control of their own existence and break out of that mold of being ruled over by others and become an independent nation. What does an independent nation that has just thrown off the shackles of foreign rule, what does it do? The first thing it does is set up its own government. That's exactly what the Rambam says. Im Ya'amod Melech Beit David. Where's he going to come from? Who's going to establish him as king? Where's he going to be king? In Warsaw, he's going to establish himself, say, I'm the king, fine. Over who are you king? Where's your country? Where's your palace? Where's your army? It's a joke. It's silly. It's like the false Mashiach, like Shabtai Tzvi or something, coming along and saying, I'm the Mashiach. Or a more recent example from Brooklyn, exactly the same phenomenon. A Mashiach is not someone who stands up in the middle of nowhere and says, I'm the Mashiach. That's nothing. That's worse than a joke. That's a Mashiach Shekin, Mamash. A true Mashiach is someone who is established as the ruler of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, because there are a large number of Jews present who find themselves in historical reality where they are now independent and they're able to set up this sovereign existence for themselves in Eretz Yisrael. And then the Rambam tells you, if such a person arises and is ruling over the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, and why did they get to Eretz Yisrael in the first place? Because there's always a miswa to come to Eretz Yisrael. There's always a miswa of Yerushat Haaretz and Yeshivat Haaretz and Yishuv Haaretz. And that's why the Rambam is assuming that at some point in history it'll work out, it will happen, that the Jews will come in sufficient numbers and the historical situation will be such and Hashem will help them in such a way so they'll be able to overcome all the obstacles and difficulties, and all of a sudden they'll be independent and they'll have this national, independent, sovereign existence. And then the Rambam goes on to say, such a Jewish nation with such a Jewish leadership, if they go on to do A, B, and C, then you can begin to assume this leader is the Melech Mashiach, and if he does D, E, and F, then he's Vada the Mashiach. You understand? But this whole text, this whole halakha, which is Perek Yud Aleph halakha Heth in the correct version, in some versions halakha dalet, this whole halakha in the Rambam makes no sense unless you understand that the Rambam is working on this assumption that there's always a miswa for the Jewish people to be aware of the fact that they are supposed to be a nation and not a scattered collection of communities around the world, and therefore they're always required to return to Eretz Yisrael and reconstitute their national existence. And when you do that, the first thing you do is establish a monarchy and a Jewish leadership, etc. That's what the Rambam is telling you here. So again, you see the Rambam Vadai assumes as a given that the Jewish people must return to Eretz Yisrael en masse and establish a Jewish state. This is the most fundamental assumption the Rambam is telling you here. Without that, none of what he says makes any sense. Yeah.
The Megillat Esther is coming to explain the Rambam's position, and he says that the this means it's put on hold until the Mashiach. But doesn't the Rambam himself say, I don't think he says in the Mishnah Torah, but doesn't he say that no mitzvah is dependent on the Mashiach?
Absolutely. The Rambam thinks so, but the Megillat Esther does not think so. That's what I was saying. It's paradoxical. The Megillat Esther is trying to help the Rambam, but really, it's like chalk and cheese. The two things don't go together at all.
Wait, he says to you that anyone who thinks that...
The Rambam writes this. The truth is he writes it here as well. If you read carefully this perek, which I'm not going to do now, if you read this perek, you'll see it's written here also. But the Rambam writes it explicitly in his Pirush on the Mishnah, both in the Hakdamah to the Pirush on the Mishnah and in Perek Chelek in Masechet Sanhedrin, and that's where you'll see that the 13 principles, which the version most people know, by the way, is not the Rambam's version, the original version, but the original version is to be found there. And the Rambam makes all these things very clear. He says it in Perek Shlishi on his Perush on the Masechet Sanhedrin, Perush on the Mishnah, where he talks about Chidush HaSmicha and the Sanhedrin. He says that to suggest that the Smicha will be reinstituted by the Mashiach is ridiculous. So says the Rambam. In other words, you see, the Rambam is working in terms of an approach which does not see anything in the Torah being dependent on the appearance of someone or anything of the sort. The Jewish people must and are commanded to reconstitute their national existence, all aspects of it, from within themselves, by their own power, by their own volition, by their own efforts. So that's why the Rambam is the one who comes up, it's Dafka the Rambam who comes up with the method, with the way of reconstituting the smicha. Whereas other Rishonim, who don't see it that way, so not so clear, don't have that picture so clearly in their mind, don't really address the issue of how to reconstitute the smicha when it's been lost, because you can assume maybe the Mashiach will do it, maybe Eliyahu Navi. It's all very vague. The Rambam could never countenance such an idea.
You have to be here, and everything you need to do to be here is all part of the same thing.
Well, look. Hot Melachim in Perek Hay Halacha Tethwal. The Rambam says, "La'olam yadur adam beretz Yisrael," that a Jew should always try his best to live in Eretz Yisrael. Afilu be'ir shiruba goyim, while yadur bechutz la'aretz. Afilu be'ir shiruba Yisrael. This is Halacha in the Rambam. Shekol ayaseh lechutz la'aretz kiro vedavodah zarah, etc. So the idea of living in Eretz Yisrael is essential and a given.
Okay.
But here the Rambam was talking about the individual, and I was and we were speaking previously about the nation as a whole, and that's the difference. But it's all part of one thing. That was the point we were trying to make.